This episode is supported by friend of the show, Dave Wagner. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures.
Big Adventures and Steve Hatch, synonymous, but you know, he and I have known each other for years and years and years because we were kids, you know, kid boatmen and stuff like that, right, Steve?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, forever.
Forever.
I remember Bryce driving the boom truck around with you sitting on the hook ball.
Oh, yeah.
Swinging. You're the cutest little kid I ever saw.
The good old days with Bryce and the Pierce Ferry winch truck.
Yeah, Bryce was great.
Back when Pierce Ferry was a bay and warm, clear water.
Yeah, lot.
90 degrees.
Crazy how much things have changed down there in Lake Mead. And that'll be a good part of this conversation, actually, is the state of our river and water flows, because you and I have had a chance to really watch it for our lives. Yeah, like some other people in this neighborhood. And so that'll be an interesting perspective that you give us as to where we've been, where we're going to go, and where are we going with this whole water thing. But I really like kind of doing a backstory on... Were you born in Vernal?
Born in Vernal, Utah, 1969.
You know, you don't know anybody until you know somebody born in Vernal. You know, you really don't.
Yeah. The original river-running hub, I guess.
Well, it was. It's an amazing history of your family. So you grew, did you go to high school in Vernal?
Oh, yeah. I was there from the time I was born until I went off to college. And that would have been 1987. I went off to school in Salt Lake. So, yeah.
Did you go to the U or did you go to Brigham Young? Or
I went to University of Utah and got a degree in commercial recreation, which I'm one of the few people.
Yeah, no kidding. Seems kind of applicable for where you have ended up here.
Very much so.
And for the listener, Hatch is probably historically one of the oldest companies... A lot of history there, and we're going to get you to talk a little bit about the roots of the company. Family-owned, your uncle and your father ran it. Now Steve runs it. It's a family-owned company, well enshrined in Grand Canyon, Hatch River Expeditions, but all over the Southwest, really. I mean, and West. Like,
yeah.
Talk a little bit about the roots here. Your grandfather... started the company?
Yeah, so my grandpa, Bus Hatch, started in 1929, did the first trip on the green. That's when he started. And then in 1934, he did his first trip through the Grand Canyon. That was titled the Dusty Dozen Trip with a bunch of relatives. Got through in 34. And then later on in 1940, he did the first descent of the Middle Fork of the Salmon in Idaho. Then in 1956, he did the first descent of the Indus in Pakistan. Also in 1940, he took the first woman down the Yampa River that we know of, and that was my grandmother, Eva, who my daughter is named after. So that kind of was our foot in the door, so to speak, back then. And
what an amazing... He must have been one hell of a guy. I mean, back then, having the courage and the just that... venture built into him to go do some of those first descents. And oh, he must have been a very interesting man.
It might have been a little bit of lack of concern. Like, he didn't seem to care much. He just wanted to be outdoors, hunting, fishing, camping, away from town, away from work. He was a contractor by trade, so he built houses, swimming pools, anything anybody needed back in the 30s and 40s.
In Vernal.
The house that I was raised in was built by him. It was also the company's office back when Hatch was all one company. And that was in the 70s, they split my father and my uncle. But prior to that, we did the Middle Fork of the Salmon. We did Cataract. We did Green. We did the Yampa. We did Grand Canyon. We were all over the place. We had a sailway permit for a while. So we were all over the place, which at the time was difficult from the stories I've been told, because we were spread out too thin. Couldn't focus on any one location. Our cataract permit was doing really well. It was actually outpacing our Grand Canyon trips back then in the 70s, mostly geology, Colorado School of Mines, things like that. So that was where we were doing well. And then my father and my uncle Don got to a point where they didn't get along so well business-wise. And it actually put a big divide in the family for quite a while. But towards the end of my Uncle Don's life, they were able to kind of patch that up
and work through it. So I remember all that, but yeah. I wasn't ever sure how that took its course.
In the end, I think things were good between the two brothers, but there was about 10 years in there where, you know, all the cousins got together and we played together and we did stuff together, but the two brothers weren't as close as they used to be. But then towards the end, they did. So they were able to make up some of that ground towards the end before we lost my Uncle Don.
Yeah. Both great guys, both Don and your dad. I was closer to Ted than any of you guys until now. And I really always had a real affection for the clan in general. But great guys, those guys.
Yeah, and both those brothers were highly vested in the success of the business. The problem was they both saw it from different ways.
Yeah.
My father Ted was more of the businessman, and my Uncle Don was more of the river runner. My Uncle Don wanted to just be on the river. He was more like you and I, Brian, where it's maybe we'll leave the office behind and get on the boats. Whereas my father, he saw more of the business side of it. And
yeah.
And that's why we had the largest contract in Grand Canyon for decades. It was because the family went out and sold that aggressively to be where we're at today.
Well, and now with that, when they put a ceiling on the user days, I think your dad was probably the smartest one in the whole lot because he got a lot of people on the water and set a precedence for the company to where he got a good allocation, right?
Yeah, when the Park Service came in and said, we're going to take an average, and I think it was over the next 3 or 4 seasons, what your average use was, and that was going to be the cap for the industry based on those outfitters that were doing trips. My dad saw the writing on the wall, and he said, I'm going to sell this trip to everyone I can. He went to Boy Scout groups and said, look, how do we get you on the river? And it had to be cheap. So you bring the food, I'll bring the boats. Let's get something figured out. He went to a lot of universities. He gave presentations. And as you well know, Brian, if you sat down with Ted Hatch for 10 minutes in a room, you were going to do a river trip with him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, just absolutely. A robust and charming, charming guy, you know. But definitely Ted Hatch. And that boy knew how to throw a party.
He threw the best parties, and he got more people on the river than anyone. And, you know, when I was a young kid, I remember a few stories very vividly. Having dinner in our kitchen in the house that my grandfather built. It was a 2-bedroom upstairs, and the basement was where the office was for all of our operations, all of our permits, back when the brothers were still together. And I remember sitting at dinner, and to get to the office downstairs, you had to go through the kitchen into the basement. And we'd be sitting there having dinner and we'd get a knock at the door and it would be 5 or 6 Germans from somewhere out of the country here to do a river trip. And they'd knock on the door and want to sign up for a 1-day river trip. And those river trips were $35. And my dad so happily at 7 o'clock at night got up from dinner, went and opened the door, took them downstairs and booked their trips. And that's the way it was. We did river trips and that's all there was to it. And if we had space, we were going to put people on boats. And, you know, I just remember those days as a young kid playing in the yard with all the boatmen that came off their trips.
Oh,
From the, you know, the 4-day Ladors, the Yampas, or coming back from Idaho.
I'll bet that was cool.
It was really great. You know, we had a lot of moments where you'd be out in the yard and you'd be helping the boatman trying to do anything you could at 7, 8 years old, 10 years old. And they were always so helpful. They had to be because their boss was
right around the corner.
Yeah. So it was really an entertaining summer back in those days. And I got to meet a lot of the older Hatch boatmen in their transition.
Historical figures at this point.
Yeah. Very historical. You know, I have stories of Kent Grua there in town when he first went to work for Hatch on his first trips ever. pushing me in a swing when I was just a little kid. And then, of course, our good friend Whale, meeting all of those guys at over the years at a very young age.
Yeah.
And looking back on those going, those were some amazing times. Because I feel that each generation is the transition from the older to the newer. But I truly feel like I bridged that gap quite a ways since I've been doing this for so long. Because I knew a lot of those older guys, back to Billy and Whale and Groozy and Hallett and all of those amazing guys took me in and helped me appreciate my love for the canyon.
Yeah.
For just rivers in
general.
Well,
and I think I have a similarity there too. You know, we were just kids and we're rubbing elbows with the giants of the industry back then. And your dad was that. He was always great to me. And we threw some pretty good parties together, but he particularly taught me how to throw a large format party. I could never equal his grandiose design, but oh my God, we've got some good ones there. Now, how did that go, taking the reins from Ted eventually?
Well, I struggle with dates and times, especially with my father's death, because it's not one of those moments I cherish. But what I can tell you is that he was 72, and he was still working full-time running the company. And I had been hounding him for the better part of probably 5, 6, 7 years to do a transition plan so that he could retire and so that I could buy the company. And he kept telling me for years and years that he was going to do that. We were going to work through it. We'll pick some time and it'll happen. And then one day he came in and he said, I'm done. It was that simple. Came in and said, I'm done. Let's sell this thing. And I said, whoa, 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 whoa. I've been wishing for this for decades, but I am not ready to buy this company. We have no transition plan. We have done nothing. So we need to figure this out. And he said, well, let's just sell it outright and we can all retire. And I said, well, let's sell it, but let's sell it to me. And he said, are you sure you want to do this? And I said, yeah, this is all I've ever done. This is what I want to do. And I want to carry on the Hatch name as long as I can. And I was fairly young then. I was in my mid-20s, late-20s. And I just remember that day as being such a shock because he had cancer, and that was the pivotal moment where he said, I'm done.
Yeah.
Not because he was dying, because he wasn't. He got past the cancer. He beat it, and he was living a great life, but that was the transition. He decided, okay, now I need to do some other things, and he didn't know what he was going to do, much like I don't when I retire. And so he just said, I'm done. I'm going to retire. And we had to come up with a plan, and I figured out how I was going to buy the company, and I placed an offer that he had to approve of, and he approved it, and we moved ahead. And it was only just a few short years after that he passed away.
Yeah. So he woke up one morning and said, done.
Done. It was that simple for him.
How interesting.
And I had been hounding him for so long to get a transition plan so that he could have some of those hours, days of his life left to do what he wanted.
Right.
He didn't need to work anymore. The company was successful, you know.
Oh, hell yeah.
And people ask me all the time, you know, how is this owning this business that you didn't create? And I'm like, well, this is all I've ever done. And this is all I've ever loved. So it's been good. But statistically, if you look, the first generation starts the business. The second generation usually builds it. And the third generation usually screws it up.
Destroys it.
So here I am, the third generation going, oh boy, what is it that we do and why do we do it? And I just really tried to focus on the love of the river and what I do.
Yeah.
And that was being a guide at the time. So I knew what the customer experience was like, what the guests were wanting to do, and how that went. So I just need to learn the book side of it.
I think that's something probably missing with some businesses is the leadership doesn't really know the ground floor. And that's a great way to start into being a manager is being on the ground floor initially, right? Start from the ground up.
And that's where I started. Nothing was beneath me. And everything was above me.
Oh, yeah.
So I started with just, you know, this in the summers when I was too young to go on the Grand Canyon trips as a crew member when I was 10, 11, 12, 13. my dad would send me down and just say, help out. Just go help out. You're not getting paid. You're not getting tipped. Just go help out on the trips. Go help out in the shop. That's what I did. I wasn't for want of money back then. I didn't need it. I had parents that were raising me. So it was pretty simple.
Yeah.
Just show up and help out. Let the boatman boss you around. And hopefully you provided some value to what they were doing so that you could get on the...
Entertainment, yeah. To say the least.
And hopefully they would say, yeah, let's get him on the river. And so by the time I was 13, I started going down and just learning how to swamp. Still no pay, just go on the trips, learn how to do this. And
yeah.
then a couple seasons after that, it turned and I started swamping.
Yeah, and got your basics down, and then you took the job, right?
Yep.
And then you worked your way through that. Now, Ted was, he would talk about a guy that worked hard in his life and had fun doing it, right? I mean, he really was a remarkable guy and a fun guy to be around. But physically, he didn't have any problems other than he had gotten through the cancer and stuff. But he worked hard until the last day, huh?
Yeah, he was a people person. He just loved people. And so it didn't matter what room he was in, what the format was. He was going to carry the day.
Yeah.
It was that simple.
And
As you well know.
Yeah.
And so when he got around people, he loved it. He loved doing river trips. He loved boating. He loved running rapids. Whitewater was his biggest thrill, and flying airplanes. And so you put those together with people, and he was that 800-pound gorilla in the room.
No, he always...
And some days it was really good, and some days you were like, I can't believe the owner's doing that.
Yeah. He had fun, and the thing all was, you know, he'd show up to the table with a couple pitchers in one hand and glasses in the other, and the guy lived his life having fun, for sure. Or at least it sure looked like that. Now, in regards to his flying, did he start flying really early in the game?
He did. He started flying in the 50s and 60s when he was real young, and he just had a passion for it, and he really enjoyed it. And when he saw his first opportunity, especially with the divide, when the brothers divided the company and my Uncle Don took the northern permits, the Middle Fork, Selway, Yampa, Green, Cat, and my dad took just Grand Canyon and half the equipment, that's when my dad realized that flying was critical to what he was trying to do, because he didn't want to relocate from Bernal. That was his home. It had been his home his entire life. And so he was going to stay there. But then he bought a 182, and he would fly it down to Marble Canyon, back when we had one of those sheds that we rented right across the street from the lodge. And we stacked gear to the ceiling in there
right.
every fall.
You guys were down there, back cave.
Down in the back cave. And I remembered when we were down there, the plane would fly in and I would wake up in the morning and it would just barely be getting light. So you knew my dad was flying 2 hours before the sun had come up. And I'd wake up and I was right between Wally and Bryce on the floor in one of the back caves. So it was tight lodging when I was 12, 13 years old. But
that explains a lot about your personality these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty interesting.
For the listener, Wally was the company pilot, and Bryce was forever the company driver.
Yep.
How many millions of miles did Bryce drive?
I mean, when you talk about Bryce, he worked in the river industry for a while. He did some work for Western for a bit, and then he ended up coming to work for us. He had gotten backed over by a dump truck in a shop and lost a leg. So he had the true wooden leg, and he was just a driver. And his deal with my dad was he lived on the property with me in Cliff Dwellers. I lived there with Bryce for a long time. And the deal was he had a free place to stay. He drove truck, and my dad bought him a truck as soon as he'd wear a truck out. And he could drive it anywhere he wanted, any time that he wasn't working. And Bryce would put 500,000 miles on a truck in about a 5-year period.
Unbelievable.
Just drive everywhere.
And that's
not counting
his
work truck.
And your dad paid for his fuel,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that was the deal. So Bryce was happy. My dad was happy. And Bryce was just another permanent fixture, much like Wally.
Oh, big time, yeah.
And for all those years, as Billy was as well. So Those were the people I grew up with, and I saw them from a very young age. And
now let's talk about Wally for a second. Where were his origins, or where did he come from?
So Wally was also a Vernal guy, born and raised, and then he went into flying, and he actually flew a Cessna 150, 150 horsepower airplane, and he flew that for Pipeline from all the way from Oklahoma to Seattle over the years, inspecting Pipeline visually. So he flew some of the more difficult stuff that you would fly as a pilot, very close to the ground, inclement weather, lots of terrain, and he did that for decades. And then he got tired, went back to Vernal, taking a break, and that's when my dad approached him to fly the 182 to do crew hauls from Pierce Ferry back in the day when we used to fly.
Yeah, no, and that was a great way to do it. We'd get flown back. The trips that I did, they were still doing that, and you got an airplane ride back to
Cliff Dwellers, yeah.
Oh, my golly, that really took the wear and tear out of you having that. You don't do that anymore.
No, we stopped doing that years ago because the trucking back then, we had, as we discussed, that Pierce Ferry winch truck. Well, that one-ton crew cab dual-tired truck was actually a over-the-road truck for many years, and we would put three motor rigs taken apart on a flatbed trailer.
Yeah, I remember it. The circus wagon.
Yeah, and we would drive that thing back to – we'd drive back to – Lee's Ferry, and we would get there. Either Bryce was driving or Howie. And if we remember the days of Howie, when
Howie, yeah.
We would get back to Lee's Ferry at about 3 in the morning, and we'd just go right to the ramp, and we'd go to sleep on the ramp, and we'd wake up at daylight, and we'd unload all those boats, re-rig them then, leave the food boxes on the trailer with the old food. And then we'd shuttle those boats across the river. And if you remember those days. Hatch used to have 20-plus motor rigs tied across the river. And every day, every other day, we'd drive a little red boat we called the submarine because we sunk the thing so many times and getting stuck on the river with the fluctuations.
Yeah, with a little outboard on
it. Yeah, we'd drive that across the river. And we had an old Briggs & Stratton generator and a shop vac, and we would blow up all of those boats. And whoever had to blow up the boats for that day was over there 4 or 5 hours just keeping those things from sinking because they were all vintage World War II.
I was lucky enough to get old Dave Demery to sit down, and so my loyal listeners are much more educated as to the properties of neoprene and stuff. And so much of that rubber, like those 20 boats, was mostly cotton impregnated.
All cotton core, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a big deal right there.
Well, if you remember, back when Billy was doing so much rubber work in her shop, which is who taught me to do rubber, he'd always look at me. Middle of the day, we'd call it knee-high in cotton because when you'd buff the floors out of those to replace them, it would just leave piles of cotton and neoprene mixed with Gecko-Flex on the floor that was almost knee-high in places. It was unbelievable. And every once in a while, Billy would stop and just look at me and go, how many 40-year-old T-shirts do you have? Because that was the same material. It was just a cotton cord neoprene-covered boat. And we ran those boats probably 20 years too long. We just kept fixing them and running them.
Fixing and running them. I remember those boats, and I remember those massive amount of rubber across the river. But you guys did a smart thing compared to a lot of the companies that were trying to nurse cotton. Is you had a vulcanizer.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal. I mean, I remember taking some stuff up there and getting Billy to vulcanize patches for me on rubber. And
we got to a point with the cotton where it was getting so thin that even if you patched it, the patches wouldn't hold very well because you had so much cotton exposed. But we could vulcanize it and get a little more life out of it. So if we had a hole, we would stitch it and then vulcanize it, and that would help seal the hole so it didn't leak. And you don't do that in this day and age much, but I still actually do vulcanize boats once in a while.
I was going to ask you if you still have that.
I still do. We put some new hot plates in it, and I'm the only one that runs it now. Scott was the last one that ran it with me, Scott Perry. He did a bunch of vulcanizing with me over the years. And I still do that every spring. I still call Dave Demery up and get a batch of uncured fresh gum, and I put it in my freezer to keep it as fresh as I can and vulcanize when I need to. If I get one of his big boats that I get a rip in, which is almost never, but if I get one, I will vulcanize it because it'll hold longer and it won't leak. But we don't do the inside-outside patches like a lot of people do. We stitch and patch, and if it's big enough, we'll vulcanize still to this day.
Yeah, no, it's a great improvement over almost any patch.
The durability is amazing. Well, and that's basically how Dave still makes his boats today. When he puts them in the autoclave, it's the same thing. It's heat and pressure.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Now, I understand, since we're on the subject of boats, that you're getting some new boats for this year or have gotten. How many boats did you get?
We just bought two NRS boats. We're going to give those a try. I've run a demo that they've had multiple times down the canyon with an electric motor on it. And so I know how tough the boats are because those electric motors at the time were challenging. So we're trying two of those. I have two of them in the shop, and they're orange and black. So they're perfect for us. We're looking forward to them. JP will be running one, and I'll have the other one assigned out here shortly. And they're in the shop blown up right now. We're getting ready to go for the season.
Yeah, I haven't seen them yet. I've heard some people that have seen them since they're sharp.
Yeah, they're a good-looking boat, and we've done.
Did you get the side tubes too?
Yeah, did the side tubes, did the whole package. Went with the longer side tubes, actually. GCE had moved up to a 25-foot side tube as well, and I saw those and how nice they were for extra room and just more comfort. You know, you can walk to the back of that side tube and step into the motor well.
Yeah,
on that
see, that's where I would think that they'd be really super nice instead of having to bridge that gap.
We tried to have them built with everything in mind on the first round, and NRS was very good to really work with me. They gave me a factory tour. We went down and helped finish those boats.
Where are those built? Is it in Cal?
No, they're built in Tecate, so northern Baja. And so you just cross the border there in town, and their facility, it's amazing. And their employee base, it's amazing. It's the cleanest rubber boat shop I've ever seen. They have millions of dollars of rolls of material, all different colors and weights, and it's unbelievable. I spent the entire day there just doing a factory tour, and I was so impressed with the workmanship. Their employees are, I think on average, the ones that are actually assembling boats are 10 to 20 year employees. So they have a lot of experience.
So they're taking care of them.
They're taking great care of them.
And it's in Mexico where they built the thing. How long ago did they build the facility?
They've had multiple facilities. Their first one didn't pan out so well. They had to move stuff up into the upper loft part and back and forth. So they finally got another factory just down the street. As most people, if they've been to Tecate before, it's not a very big town. I'm there a lot with racing. So it's just on the eastern side of town. It's still right in town. You're only two blocks from the border, and it's a huge facility. It's probably 100,000 square feet.
It might be one of the bigger industries of the town, or maybe
it's got to be one of the bigger industries. And the employee base is amazing. You know, they've got wonderful staff that works there. They do everything in house. They make the D-rings right there. They cut, they build, they finish, they clean right there in that factory. They have multiple rooms. They have buffing rooms that are air-conditioned with high-pressure vacs in them so that you don't see any rubber dust. It's unbelievable.
Really cool.
It's an amazing facility, and I was real appreciative. Because when you first are buying boats made out of the country, why are you buying them from somewhere out of the country is the first question you always have to ask yourself. And usually it's to save money. Right? Because of labor expense.
But probably a good answer.
Yeah, you go over to Tecate and you look at their factory and you see how well those people are treated, how well their shop is built, the standards that they operate by. It's amazing. It was truly impressive.
Well, and you got to love the culture of Mexico, and they're our southern neighbor. It's not like you're going to Taiwan or to China to bring in goods from across the pond. I mean, it's right there,
and they're great people.
It's good to hear that they're taking good care of those people too.
It's they're an amazing company, quite honestly, on the international level.
And Mexico probably loves having industry like that.
And NRS is all above board in Mexico. They're not doing anything shady down there. You know, you always see people, and there are always rumors and conjecture of what's happening down there and in those countries. And
yeah.
They're all above board, and they seem to be doing a great job. So that's why we took that leap of faith and ordered two of those boats, and they're sitting in my shop ready to go.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing those.
Yeah.
And so they have 25-foot side tubes?
They have 25-foot side tubes, so I really like the fact that you can step from the side tube into the motor well.
Oh, I think that would be a big, big improvement.
It's a huge improvement, and it sounds so simple, but remember
when you're
back
on those boats all day, every day.
Back and forth, having people
little
move.
Things like that come out to be big.
Each generation of boat we build, we're trying to change things to make it better. We're trying to take a solid step forward in every generation that we do. As you well know, those boats don't change design a whole lot over the years. And so when you do get a new boat or a new frame, you try to incorporate the best ideas that you have, because it might be a while.
You're going to have the thing. Yeah. I've always said that when I was building the sport boats, it's like you kind of have to live with the last boat you built, because they've got you.
Mm-hmm.
And you have one of those boats.
Yeah, I've got one of your boats.
That was my favorite one.
And it should have been, because I still think it's probably the best boat that was produced of all the sport boats that are out there.
Ah, thank you.
It is a really good boat, and it's still
it's a gem.
Pristine.
And that engine is still running like a red day?
It runs perfect. The 90 horse on an Osprey is the way to go.
Yep.
I've run it through CAT a couple of times. Scott ran it through CAT a couple of times.
Yep.
He did a high water trip up there. I think I might be up there on a high water trip this year.
It's going to be high water.
Yeah. Scott called me the other day, left me a voicemail, said, hey, we got a CAT trip we're going to do in the end of June. And I started looking at the water possibly.
Your heart started pounding.
I started to sweat.
Yeah, breaking into a sweat. That you kind of touched on the word racing. Can we talk a little bit about your racing career? I mean, you've been riding bikes forever that I've known you. But let's talk a little bit about that whole Baja motorcycle racing we're talking.
Yeah, so I grew up as a dirt bike rider in Utah. It was a very common thing. I went to college. I couldn't afford a dirt bike anymore. So I went almost 16 years without a bike at all. And then a friend, Trent Keller over at Western, called me and said, hey, let's go for a ride. I've got a buddy's bike. You can ride that. Let's just get out. You're riding a little bit. Let's go out and ride. I got back on a bike after 16 years and went, what have I been missing? So then, and that was in my mid-30s. So I went back to motocross racing at the vet level and had some success there. And then I blew out my back, of course, doing that. And Nate Avery fixed me. He waved the magic wand over me.
Yeah.
So Nate fixed my back. I kept riding. And then I have a friend in Kanab, Utah, who called me one day and said, hey, we've got this really fast guy from California that wants to race the Baja 1000, and you know who he is, and he wants to get a team together, and you should head up the team. You'll be the money guy. And I said, maybe.
Yeah,
a definite maybe.
Thanks a lot.
I've always wanted to race Baja, but, you know, tell me about this. And he said, well, let me put you in touch with this gentleman. His name was Carlin Dunn. Carlin called me, and he said, hey, let's do this. Buy two bikes, get them set up. I'll mentor you through this. I've raced it before. He's won many championships. He races off-road. He's top level pro, and he wanted us to race the top level pro class. So I said, you know what? We're going to do this. It's going to cost me a lot of money. I got to buy two dirt bikes and parts and chase crews and all that. So I said, all right, let's do this, but let's do it right. And he said, okay, let's do this right. And so we did. Started with two bikes. We did our first race, the Baja 1000, and it was a point-to-point, and it started in Ensenada and went 1,200 miles, just short of 1,200 miles, to La Paz.
Amazing.
And we finished sixth overall bike, and that was our first attempt.
Wow.
My first attempt. My first attempt at ever actually desert racing. So in the Pro Unlimited class, we were sixth. We were sixth overall bike, and against the entire field of all the trophy trucks and buggies and, you know, everything imaginable out there, we were 23rd overall. So we beat most of the trophy trucks as well. So it was the drug of
inspiring
choice. Yeah, it was an addiction from then on. So I've been racing Baja trips pretty much ever since, doing 1, 2, 3, 4 races a year. We've raced the whole series. We won the whole series 1 year in the Pro 50 class, now that I'm old. So this last year, we raced the Pro 50 class. We won that. The year before that, we won the championship. So we were the 500X bike for 1 year. And now, this year, we have no plans for that. But I am racing a lot of off-road. I'm racing one series nationally, the AMA Hare and Hounds in the Pro 50 class. And
where is that held?
That's all over the Southwest. So this weekend I go to Idaho to race outside of Boise. I'll race Nevada, California, Utah this year in that series. And it's a national level series.
So it's kind of a tour, like F1 travels everywhere.
Yeah, and it's in the West. So it's the AMA West Hare Scramble Series, or National Hare and Hound Series. Sorry, not the Hare Scrambles. I won that series last year, and then I also concurrently am racing the Arizona State Series.
You're having great success.
Yeah. I like that kind of racing.
What kind of bike are you on? Tell us a little bit about the machine.
Well, this year I've kind of gotten to a smaller bike because I was always racing the 450 KTMs in the States. And my Baja racing, I was always racing the Honda 450X. And those were the bikes I still use for the Score Series in Baja. But I'm racing a KTM 350 this year. We just had one race in California a few weeks ago. I did well, not as well as I would like, but I was on the box with a third place. And I'm racing against ex-pros that were factory-sponsored riders, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. So
some serious racers. And they just age out after a while? Or it's got to be somewhat of a young man's sport.
It is really a young man's sport. You'll see in the younger classes, you'll have 20 bikes in a class. And in my group, there's sometimes 20 bikes. When we do California, you'll get 20 bikes in our class. But on average, it's 10 to 15 bikes. And the talent is good, though, you know, because when you get to the 50A, 50 pro level, you are looking at guys who used to race a lot.
Yeah, and you're still serious about it enough to be racing, right? Yeah. I mean, so your experience levels are probably pretty good guys there, I would imagine.
Yeah, a lot of good competition.
Now, when you go to a big race like the Baja 1000 or 1200 or whatever, and you've got several riders, and I know my nephew Scott Perry was running down there as support. What do you have, a trailer with bikes and parts? And tell us about your little show there, road scene.
It is a traveling circus. Scott was my personal chase driver. He was in a truck with a spare parts bike for me. You can only have the one bike enter the race, and it has to finish, but you can change out all of the parts. You can't change out the motor, but you could rebuild the motor. So we strategically place parts bikes with each rider. So now I'm up to 4 bikes of the same build for my race effort.
And they're all the same build, so you have the redundancy of parts.
We have parts everywhere, tire sets everywhere, and then each team member, and usually we'll race the 1,000 with 4 or 5 riders generally. So we'll do 200 to 300 miles for each rider, which is about 4 to 8 hours, depending on the section. Some of it's high speed, some of it's more technical and slow. So then we get a game plan on who's doing what your strong suits are. Are you better at higher speed?
Oh, you'll look at the terrain.
And then we'll go pre-run. I know the 1 year with Scott when we were down there, he and I spent almost a month down there pre-running, learning the course, going over everything, because it's 1,200 miles and it's in a line. It's not a loop. So you can't just go say, well, let's go look at the start today, and then tomorrow we'll look at the finish. Because
it's in a line.
It's a 2.5-day drive.
Yeah, that's wild. So, how do you remember 1,200 miles unless you take some time, right?
It takes some time, and then you try to learn your section, and hopefully your team will get the bike to you.
And when you're in the race, How tight is it to the other competitors? Are you alone a lot, or are you head-to-head, or what sort of a...
Yeah, it's both. This last year, I started the 1,000. We started at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm a night guy. I love to race at night because I do better. There's less distraction. And I put the bike into an 11-minute lead. When I got off the bike, we held that lead to mile 300-ish. We bumped it out to about a 15 to 20-minute lead at mile 300. And then our third rider got on the bike and wrecked hard. And he lost all of that time. And we then were in second place behind the previous year's pros that had beat us. And so we were behind them and catching them. And then that leader went down and had to be life-flighted to San Diego for he had everything broken. So he was done. And we got some good Samaritan time because we were there on the scene helping get the evac done for about half an hour. So we were in a fairly tight race then. And then it just opened up and we finished with about a 6-hour lead over second place by the end.
Oh, wow.
But that's not always the case. 2 years ago, we did a 1,000 and we had a change for the lead, us and the same team, back and forth for 600 miles.
Just within, neck and neck.
Within 3 to 5 minutes for 600 miles through two nights of racing. The first night, I actually lost some time to the leader, and then we got it back, and then we were going to put our faster guys on towards the end of the race, and we started making up that time, and then we had light issues, and we lost 2 hours, so we lost to our main competitor by about an hour and a half.
Neck and neck. I bet you got tired of seeing them show up over the hill. Huh?
Every time you'd be at a new pit chasing for the team, you'd see their bike come through or our bike come through. And within a couple minutes, the next team was coming through. And you were like,
damn.
It was as good a racing as you get for that sort of distance. The races are 22 to 26 hours long nonstop. And
yeah.
So when you're racing for 15 of those and you're within 3 to 5 minutes for 15 hours, it gets tiring.
Yeah,
but it's
fine. I bet it adds up by the end of your race. You probably pretty beat pup.
Yeah, this last race, we were up. Not this last one, the last 1,000 that was to La Paz. I was up for 35 hours straight. I raced the bike in two different sections, and then I chased for the team, and I'd go from pit to pit down the course trying to keep up with the race bike.
Wow.
On the highway. And we pulled into La Paz about half an hour ahead of our team by the time we got there. So Jeremiah was my chase driver on that race, and we were up for 35 hours straight without any sleep. So it was tough.
Brutal.
It was tough, but it was those are memories you'll never forget.
Yeah, no, that's cool stuff.
Yeah.
And so what's your next race?
So this weekend I head to Idaho for a national level race. It'll be about 3 hours, open desert with a bomb start. And then the next week after that, in
Utah. What do you mean a bomb start?
How bomb starts work is they take each class, and not the 50A class or the 50B class. They take all the A riders, and I'm an A rider, so I'll be one row behind all of the pros. So we start row 2, and they'll have us all line up side by side out in the middle of the desert, and there will be 100 to 200 bikes in my row, and they will take a truck way out in the desert about 2 miles away. You can just barely see it, and they'll hold up a big banner. When they drop that banner, it's start your motors and race.
It's go time.
And it's crazy because you're going flat out through the desert as fast as you can go.
With people all around you.
People all around, and you're trying to get a good start. And then you file into either single track or two lane or sand wash or something. And then it's 3 hours on the bike. So
can you get lost?
Oh, yeah. I know people that have gotten lost. I've taken some missed turns before and it cost me a couple minutes. You know, you'll go a little ways and go, wait, the tracks aren't here. The flagging's not here. So you backtrack and find it. So I've lost some time before. I've heard of people being out there for hours, not knowing where the course was.
Yeah. So they just don't pick up that they're on the.
Yeah. So it can happen. Doesn't happen very often, but you know, it's one of those type of races where there's more to the strategy than just going really fast. So it's good. It's a good type of racing.
What is the least durable part on your bike Like, what do you go through the most of as far as parts?
The most commonly replaced part on my bike is the tires.
The tires do take a beat.
Every race, new tires.
Yeah.
It's hard on tires. You're in a desert environment. You're running single track in some places that is nothing but giant rocks for, you know, at 10, 15, 20 miles an hour, and then you break out into fast desert sections where you're doing 80 and 90 miles an hour.
So you You're at those speeds. Wow.
Not very often, but I'll hit in almost every race 80 to 90 miles an hour. So it's high speed, it's slow speed, and there's lots of
in between.
Lots of objects.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet it is brutal.
So yeah, but it's tires. But the bikes nowadays are so incredible. They're so durable. If I was in Mexico and somebody said, you've got to find a way to get home, what's your vehicle of choice? It's going to be a bike because they hold up so well.
Uh-huh. And they've got disc brakes?
They're all disc brakes. The bike that I'm on, the 350 that I'm racing this year, is 50 plus horsepower. So it's super fast and powerful. Its top speed is about 96, 97 miles an hour.
Whoa. So, amazing. And then what kind of fuel? Just regular fuel?
Yeah, they run 91. I run Avgas in mine because I have access to it here in Flagstaff. But yeah, we just run a good clean fuel and nothing crazy.
And are there two strokes?
They're four strokes.
They're four strokes. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I do race two strokes here in Arizona, though, the fuel injected ones. Just a different type of racing, really tight technical single track stuff where a 60-mile race will take you 4.5 hours. So I do race two strokes for those.
And your advantage there is lightness and fast out of the hole.
Yeah, they're just a nice light bike. They're agile. They're more fun to ride, but not at speed.
Yeah.
The four strokes are better at speed.
Uh-huh.
It's a great sport.
So then after Idaho, where do you go?
I'll be in Utah, Jericho in the sand dunes. We have two races there, almost back-to-back coming in April. Then we'll have one more to finish the first half of the national series the first week of May. And then we take summer break, and then we'll finish in end of September and October.
Uh-huh.
So that on average, there's 6 to 10 races in a series, and I made all of them but one last year. So
you've got a serious schedule going
on
there.
Yeah, and then you had the Arizona State Series with AMRA. I'm averaging more than two races a month. And it takes me about a week just for the body to recover to where I even want to look at a motorcycle again.
Yeah, I'll bet. Now, do you wear back bracing? You wear all the armor, right?
Actually, I don't. I wear a helmet. I wear a Camelback. I wear boots. I wear dirt biking pants.
Gloves,
goggles, and that's about it. There's some safety gear out there that's somewhat effective, but it's not as effective as we would like. So we make some difficult choices.
Well, I do recall you were pretty hurt there a time or two.
Yeah, yeah.
And that took you out of it for a while.
Yeah, I had a shoulder injury. I broke my scapula of all bones. I broke my scapula in 15 places, and I had it sandwich plated both sides, and it now has a metal plate on each side of it holding it together, so the right shoulder's a lot more weak, and it won't recover. It'll only go to about 70% now, but I'm back riding, and that was a very challenging race that we had.
That sounds sore. For sure.
Yeah, it was rough. I spent 4 days in a hospital in Reno. That was the same time that I was moving my daughter to college. And so I said, hey, Mom, take Eva to college, and I'll do this race, and I'll come over from Reno after it's done and help move in. And I didn't make it. I was in the hospital for 4 days. I had a brain bleed. I had broken ribs. It was a rough time.
You did have a brain bleed?
Yeah, it was rough. I was pretty beat up, and they tried to kick me out of the hospital on day three, and I couldn't even get out of bed. I'm not a fan of morphine, but I was on morphine at the time, and it was a real challenge. And there was, you know, Sarah was in Salt Lake with Eva getting her moved in, because I did not want her to come when my daughter's just moving to college for the first time. So I was there by myself, and I had nowhere to go, and help. So I just stayed in the hospital. I was able to convince him to let me stay one more day.
Sleeping in the halls or whatever.
It was almost like that. I was like, I'm not going anywhere. So if you kick me out, I'm just going to be down the hall. But they were able to get me a room and keep me in bed. And it was a rough 6 months, actually, on that injury.
It sounds like a rough six months.
Yeah, it was tough. I
were you nervous the next time you got on a bike?
No.
That's what a good brain bleed will do for you. You're not scared at all.
You have to be at a point in your life where you are willing to accept what you're about to do. And if you can accept that, you need to accept it fully.
Oh, yeah. The whole enchilada.
So when I'm racing, I don't think about getting injured. I don't think about consequences. I think about performance and...
You think about those three boxes at the end of the gleam of the trophy.
The fact that
the adoration of your competitors.
That I'm going to ride a smart race, I'm going to have fun, and I'm going to push it. Because I tell people this all the time, but the only time that my mind is free is when I'm racing a dirt bike.
Yeah.
I always have something on my mind all the time. And when I'm out racing, I don't. And it is the definition of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I kind of feel that way when I ski. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you're locked in. You're committed to what you're doing.
There's no distraction.
Similar. Now let's change channels just for a closing thought about the water. Let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on the incredible shrinking reservoirs and the low water and the. Where do you think it's headed? I mean, this is a hell of a winter that we are experiencing, which is kind of ironic because we've been in this drought and we haven't had a really big hit in winter like this for a few years. And it's kind of funny. Everybody's starting to really, it's getting everybody's attention when the reservoirs have gotten as low as they've gotten. But what is your thinking on what we're going to be doing in Grand Canyon, especially in regards to large motor craft? And it's hard to project what to do, I'm sure.
Well, when you look at business models, just statistically from a business standpoint, what are you going to do with a change? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you, Brian, that I'm going to now take the 13 motor rigs I have and turn them into rowboats and accommodate everyone, because that's not possible.
No.
And it's not affordable in any way, shape, or form. But I think I look at this a little differently than a lot of other people. I don't, and there's no pun intended here, but I'm a glass half full guy, not a half empty guy.
Yeah.
And I think based on the last 20 years of water that we've had, if we do forecasts for that, we can have enough water to do river trips. And I also believe that, and it's hard for me to say this, but the power demand in the summer is a driving force to release water. That's the same time we want to be down there as well. So there is that the belief, at least that I have, that there is a sustainable water level that can be had, that we can run the boats that we're currently running. We'll take some hits and it'll have some moments, but I believe that if they can keep us on average at that 8,000 or higher, we're going to be okay.
Oh yeah.
As you and I well know, I learned to run cotton motorboats through Grand Canyon on quite a few of those continuous 4-day cycles of 5,000 CFS. We remember those.
Oh
days.
Yeah, when I was doing the science, we were even on sometimes less water than that, and we broke everything.
And you break things, but that's how you learned it as well. And you got better at it over time.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being down there at Hance a couple times on day two of the 5,000 flow. And you've, just to get to that point in that day, you've pulled the motor 30 times.
Oh, yeah.
You pull in and there's 20 motor rigs sitting there looking, just waiting for someone to see if they're, who's going to go first. And then you end up going and it's not horrific. You get through, it's challenging. We've had our moments there, of course. Whale had some moments there, of course. But those are the low of the lows. The 8,000 flows are more manageable. And right now, for this next year, given the gift that we're seeing out the window right now, I think the flows are going to be okay through this year and next year. They're not going to be great, and there's definitely a problem that needs to be addressed.
That's kind of how I see it, and a lot of it, I think, has to do with how they decide to manage a productive dam, the flows, and the conservation of the... I mean, everybody keeps talking about this Deadpool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can manage that lake above the Deadpool rather than take it to the Deadpool. And that means maybe you cut the water off, but you've still got water that, if you are making releases, can still go through your penstock. So I think it's a little misguided as to what they can do for us as an industry.
I don't think that the hydropower interests have had to do anything substantially since the Grand Canyon, what is it, Conservation Act?
Since yeah, they really haven't.
Ramping rates and all that still could be adjusted a lot. And when they start taking into consideration recreational users as well, maybe we can all find some common ground there. I know that it's the most commonly asked question in my office when people call about their trips coming up. Will we have enough water? And our answer is yes. Is it what we would like? No, but it's still good flows that are reasonable.
Yeah.
If you look at the forecast for this year, especially with what's happening now with all the snowpack, especially in Colorado and parts of Utah, this year looks reasonable. But let's not release it all this year. Let's do what we need to conserve.
Well, and I do think it's kind of ironic that we have a year like this, because it seems like only in the last couple of years have so many entities woken up and said, oh, look, our reservoir's dried up. You know, it's like it hasn't been talked about nearly what it is now. And they should be able to recover the Lake Powell a little bit. You know, I mean, they can bring that lake up just from this year to a degree. You know, it's not going to recover the thing. We're still in a drought.
I couldn't agree more. I personally believe that this was the shot across the bow.
Yeah.
Right? And now we've been given this gift. How are we going to manage this gift, all this water?
Yeah, good point.
And we saw the greediness, and I'm greedy as well. I'm not going to say I'm not. I want to run the Grand Canyon on reasonable flows. But I also believe there's give and take.
Yeah.
And I think there's been a whole lot more take with the water because people have been able to. We've seen the states blow through the time frame they had set for compromise. And we all look and point the finger at everybody else, but what are we doing to help with this problem? Because I know right now Nevada, I've been told, is doing a very good job of conserving their water, much better than the state of Arizona.
I think I'm a little disappointed with California going, well, we're just not even going to interact now.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, they're not playing well with others, particularly on this.
They haven't.
But also, you know, it's a little silly to be dividing up what you don't have. And that's basically what we've been doing there for a long time.
We've been doing that for a long time, and we need to adjust that.
Yeah.
And I think there's room in the system to have most needs met. It's not just shutting down one sector of society. It's not saying, well, sorry, but no more almond trees in Southern California and no more cotton farms in Arizona. It's got to be compromise across the board by everyone. And I think California will come into play, and I think they'll sit at the table. And I think given the situation, it could be worked out. They did prove that they haven't been able to do that yet. So we just have to wait and see and hope.
But I like that analogy shot across the bow. I think you're absolutely right there, and we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Yeah.
Well, Stevie, it's been great just sitting and getting some insight on your world here. I look forward to seeing you this summer. Hopefully, are you booking up pretty good? And
bookings are solid. We're doing great. We're coming off that high from the COVID accommodation plan that we had.
Yeah.
And it was very successful, and we're back to normal, and we're looking at a good season.
Yeah. Well, good. And thanks for sitting in on this and getting to know Stevie a little bit. Steve Hatch and Brian Durker, big adventures. Thank you. And remember, you guys, COVID's still for real. Take care of yourselves and stay right side up. This is Big Adventures with Steve Hatch and Brian Durker signing out. Thanks for being here. Catch you the next time.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.